Good evening, welcome, or welcome back to Writers at Warwick. I'm Jeremy Treglone. It's a very great pleasure to have Faye Weldon with us, and a pleasure too to have Maureen Freely, who we're lucky enough to have as a lecturer at Warwick, to introduce her and to act as her interlocutor. We've been debating the pronunciation of that word, and that's what we decided on. I just want to say one or two things about events that are coming up ahead. On Wednesday, next Wednesday, the 10th of May, John Burnside, the poet and novelist, will be here. A couple of weeks after that, Gary Young, the Guardian columnist, who's the author of No Place Like Home, A Black Briton's Journey Through the American South, will be in conversation with my colleague Cicely Jones. And don't miss the 7th of June, Wednesday, when our very own Peter Blegvad, the cartoonist and writer and rock musician, will be here with his trio for a concert in this hall. So those are events that are coming up. But this evening, please welcome Maureen Freely and Faye Weldon. I always forget to say that for those of you who don't already know, that immediately after the event, the bookshop will be open. You can buy books of Faye Weldon's there. You can buy any book there at a 20% reduction if you show your ticket. And Faye will be here to sign copies, I hope.
Good evening. This is one of those unnecessary introductions. Faye Weldon is one of our most successful novelists and novelizers. She's seen books of hers in made into film, many made into television productions, and she's also taken things made for television and turned them into novels, so that's very clever. Also, just as well known for her cultural interventions, and we'll be trying to have an argument this evening on some of those interventions, feminism, therapy, the gender switch, mothers, fathers. The thing that I like about Faye's cultural interventions is that even when I disagree with her passionately, I still can't help laughing when she says whatever she's saying, because she makes me realize that whatever I believe is terribly fatuous. So so thank you for reminding me. One thing that's not very well known about Faye Weldon is how kind she is to younger novelists. She's done this in a very, very quiet way for years and years, and never talks about it, and never complains about the burden of reading other authors, but she does, so I want you to know that as well. She's also, despite her strong opinions, very difficult to disagree with, but we'll be trying very, very hard to come to some sort of disagreement this evening. At this point, I'll pass over to the real thing.
Well, I don't understand this. Jeremy, Maureen, help. Oh, I see. That's right, and there's a little light.
Does it work?
No, it doesn't matter. I can see anyway. It's just easier to read standing up. I think one of the reasons I get disagreed with was that I went to a Scottish university a long time ago, St. Andrews, where I did, I may say, economics, not English literature. And there was a kind of way of argument we had in which you overstated your case. The other person then overstated their case. You listened to what they said. You would bring your case down a little. They would hear your next level down. They would cooperate a little. And thus, by degrees, you kind of negotiated beliefs and came to agreement. But I think it's very particular to Scotland, really. And I sort of got into the habit of overstating my case very young, and these days very few people disagree with me. I wish they would, so I really hope that Maureen and I, if not come to blows, Maureen will manage to kind of put me in my place. She and I both have numbers of children. We went to a lunch organized by Women's Magazine to talk about our relationships to our children, didn't we? And I think they wanted sort of joyous quips, but all Maureen and I had was tales of disaster and woe. But there you are. So I'm going to read something called, this is a book of essays called Godless in Eden. Usually I talk about fiction. Essays actually are much easier to talk about than literature. because they are opinions, and we all have them. It's a collection of essays, sort of picked up from here and there, some written for it, some things that I'd written for various newspapers or magazines and quite liked. I don't know who this one was for, if indeed anyone. It's called Godless in Eden because it seems to me that we have reached, in a way, a promised land. We all have enough to eat, and we suffer probably from a surfeit of education, not a lack of it. We have the National Health Service. It's Eden, and the God is no longer there with his flaming sword barring the way. But somehow, so we're back in it. But it's kind of rather weedy and overgrown, and I don't even think there's a serpent to keep us in order. This essay starts, "The entrance to the Garden of Eden may no longer be barred by a flaying sword, but Mother has to get back to the baby. No way she can enter. Mothers who need them. Not employers, certainly. Mothers demand equal wages, but have their minds on things other than their employers' interests. Sick babies, for example, toddlers with chicken pox, sudden calls to the school, childcare. Mothers can't be asked to stay late, won't do overtime, use the phone a lot, won't relocate, demand maternity leave, and they don't look so good in the front office either. Erratum, sweatshop employers, rather like mothers. Desperation means mothers will put up with anything. No one else will do that job anyway. Fathers, on the other hand, are much like anyone else. Sometimes they take an afternoon off for the Christmas play or for a session with Relate and insist on having their holidays in August, but otherwise who notices? Erratum, lone fathers, of course, count as mothers. Same problem, who needs them? You can't blame employers, they're not philanthropists. The rational aim of the individual employer is to make a profit out of the worker's time and labour. If the employer is a company, it must put the profit of the shareholder before the interests of the worker, let alone the customer. If the employer is the state, a shrinking section of the new economy, managers and accountants take the place of the old-fashioned boss. Their object is to save money, not make money, which puts the employee in exactly the same situation. The pressure is on for longer hours and lower wages. The working class can kiss my arse, I've got the charge, hands job at last, as old communists used to sing. Thank you, Mr. Blair. Not that anyone admits to being working class anymore who wants the union to fight for their rights. It's an indignity, except we all go on working and earning, especially mothers, harder and longer than ever. Forget lone mothers, one average pay packet is scarcely enough to keep even a family with a father in pot noodles, petrol for the car, and nights for the kids. So out she goes to work, which is fine in one way, because being with small children alone in a house can drive you crackers, but not in another, because cramming stiff, unwilling arms into coat sleeves on a winter's morning in order to be at the nursery by 8 and work by 9 is no fun, when you and the child are both half asleep. It's no use the self-righteous, usually the childless, who can afford to be minimalist, telling you you're being greedy or materialistic, you should magically do without the extra money. You have to have a new car because the old one breaks down on the way to work, and where's the public transport? And you have to have a microwave because there's no time for proper cooking. It's a vicious circle. Since the introduction of the poll tax, no one has been able to live cheaply. Mothers, who wants them? Stay at home, if you're lucky, and be told you're boring and uninspirational. Go out to work and be told you're breeding delinquents. Mothers, who wants them, not the state. Mothers are a drain on the national purse. They're either lone or divorced and on benefit, or claiming low-income family supplement, or kicking up a fuss because their child didn't get to the school of its choice, or failing to teach it its times tables before it gets to school, or irresponsibly going out to work so it ends up delinquent. Mothers, who wants them, not even children. The creche, the nursery, the school, the after-hours homework club takes the place of home. As the traditional family turns into a unit with two breadwinners and no parent, children learn to do without mothers very fast, even grandmothers out at work. The teacher, the peer group, television and youth culture become more important in their lives, are a greater cultural influence. Watch the four-year-olds dancing to the Spice Girls, and that can be even if you don't go out to work. What's to be done? This is not a happy situation for mothers. Everyone wants to be needed. Feminism has been the only movement in recent times to turn its attention to matters of social justice, personal dignity, and the quality of our lives. Let the new feminists attend to these rather than the gap between male and female wages. Let them stop congratulating themselves on how happy they are to wear lipstick and what a good thing Mrs. Thatcher was, and extend their remit. Let them start by dividing the world into four separate categories, not two, and looking at what is really going on. Men, women, mothers, fathers, not just male and female. Let them bring about a society in which there is parity of parenting. So the problem of the working father is as much talked about as the problem of the working mother. Younger men trained by earlier feminists to have full and loving relationships with their children will cooperate, apart from a few emotional dinosaurs. We might all even end up working less hard, having fuller lives and happier relationships with our children. As for Mrs. Thatcher, it was she, remember, who in repealing the Shops Act, took away the right of the shop assistant to have a chair. Now do a little diversion and read you some piece called Behind the Rural Myth. I sort of get blamed for this kind of thing, but editors ask you to edit. Editors will ask you to write something saying sort of pro-city against the country, because and you oblige because you think it's rather fun, and then somehow you are held responsible for it, and people write letters to the papers. And this is on being asked by the features editor of the Daily Telegraph to write a piece in the wake of the Countryside March to defend the city against the country. And I wrote this piece called Behind the... And I thought it was perfectly frivolous, but people take me very seriously. Behind the Rural Myth. The countryside is pretty. It's pretty because there are so few people in it. There are so few people in it because there are so few jobs in it. And that's the nub of the matter. Yes? You can have a mobile office. Anyone can work from home in these days, in the days of the computer, email, fax, phone and scanner. Who needs the soap opera of city, of office life? Who wouldn't want green trees, not concrete, the other side of the window? So move out. Except it's insanity, isn't it? For aloneness, read loneliness. And the blinds stay down to keep the sun off the computer screen. And when the crunch comes, you're the first to go. If the boss has never seen your face, why should he bother about the look on it? And try getting the dole in the country. It's so personal. They don't just dosh it out like they do in the city. No, they read every word you've written on the form you've just filled in and compare last week's answers and look everything up in the book. They've got the time and say no. And you don't belong. The countryside is relaxing. Yes, you can tell from the clothes of the people who come up on the Countryside March. They don't have many full-length mirrors in the countryside. Country folk being either too haughty and grand to need them, or else the ceilings are too low in the cottages to fit them in. That must be it. The countryside's not for the vain. Heels sink into the mud like the heels of little Gerda's pretty red shoes in the Hans Christian Andersen story. Down and down they pulled her till she stood in the hall of the Mud King. The countryside's all practical woolly mufflers and crooked hems and garments it would be a wicked waste to throw out. The country is full of good, worthy people. A good girl in the city is a bad girl in the country. In the country, the hairstylists like to turn you out looking like their mother. Well, they do that anywhere in the world, but you get the feeling in the country they don't like their mothers very much. Not that it matters, go out for the evening and the place is hardly jumping with film crews and flash bulbs. Who's to see you? The countryside is healthy. No, it isn't. But it's unkind to go into that one. Let's just say organophosphates have made fools of us all. Who goes on to the, what goes on to the crops and what goes into the soil? We moved to the country once, kept a tranquil flock of rare breed sheep which roamed our fields in the most natural of natural ways. We fed them sheep nuts by hand. What was in the sheep nuts? Ground up protein from more than one animal of origin. Dip them, said the government. We built a trough and pushed the startled innocent animals in one by one, dripping and shaking and spluttering, nerve poison all over the place. Oh, thanks. Pollution drifts over the countryside from the cities, lingers over the valleys. And the pollen count, good Lord. Just listen to the countryside sneezing and wheezing. The cottage hospital closes. The trauma ward's an hour away. People live longer in cities. And yet, I know the warm glow of the setting sun on the old barn walls, the brilliant acid green of early spring, the blackness of night, the great vault of the firmament, the sense of a benign and fecund nature, of being part of the wheeling universe. But that's weakness, irrationality. Let's get back to the brisk facts of the matter. The countryside is our heritage. That is, it's shrinking and shrinking fast. Suburbia creeps out from the towns. 41% of British marriages end in divorce and rising. 28% of us live in single-person households and rising. We have to build houses, and build we do, no choice. And where are the bus services to get us to work from our new countryside estates? Not down our road, that's for sure. And work still stays in the city, so travel we must, and travel we do, and use the car, and know every radio presenter by heart. The countryside becomes somewhere to go, not somewhere to be. A car park here, a car park there, this way the castle, that way the old oak tree, and a fast food snack as you go. Oh, goodbye, countryside. What rats we were to leave the sinking ship. You're not cut off when you move to the country. Friends will visit. Well, the friends from the city who came down at first don't seem to come anymore. For a time they overlooked the fact that you had deserted them, ran out of them, and which is what you did, come to think of it. Nobody likes that. You looked down your nose at their way of life and left them. So soon the inconvenience gets to them, the overnight bag, the traffic and the hours that stand between you and them, your strange new friends with straw in their hair, wearing long strands of New Age beads and no proper signal for the mobile, and you've been nowhere and seen nothing except the back of the Aga. They settle you in and their duty done, abandon you, serve you right. And the friends who do persist just seem to want a free weekend. Well, of course they do. What did you expect? With you cooking and washing up, because now you're in the country, that's the kind of thing you do, isn't it? Back to nature, back to the sink, and what? No homemade bread? Friends who seem perfectly civilized for the length of a dinner reveal over a weekend all kinds of gross personal traits. Eat breakfast in their pajamas or smoke dope in front of the children or complain about no dry towels and quarrel with your neighbors knowing you're stuck with them and they can leave. Let's compromise, let's try a country cottage. That one used to work, and very well, when husbands had 9-to-5 jobs and wives stayed home and looked after the kids, but all that's in the past. Then there was time and energy to work out the logistics of transporting a family, its goods, its bedding, its games and toiletries, to a place some scores of miles away on Friday nights, and the reverse process on Sunday evening, plus guests. And it was lovely if you were skilled at logistics, that is. Log fires and cheerful talk and mild drunkenness and happy flirtations and country walks and pink cheeks and a ploughman's lunch at the pub and no one worried about drink and drive. Oh, paradise. But 9-to-5 drifts to 8-to-8. And Saturday mornings too, and women are working, and the mobile phone and the laptop turn Sundays into Mondays, and the traffic's worse, and they've tarmacked the track and lopped the trees, and it's sensible, but the romance has gone. There's a strong steel fence where you used to nip under the wire, and the badger set's been cleared for fear of TB, and what's that smoke on the horizon? Surely not a funeral pyre for the poor dead cows. Or else the right to roamers found a footpath through your garden, past your own very own back window. When change comes to the countryside, it's seldom for the better. And the village store has closed. Okay, so you never went in it. If you did, they always said pointedly, haven't seen you for a long time. so it got embarrassing. But you did like it to be there. Say no to the country cottage. It isn't what it was. The countryside's good for the children. Yes, but you wouldn't think it to listen to them. They don't sound all that appreciative. They do look at TV a lot. They miss McDonald's and running out to the corner shop. There's a strange-looking man lurking in the playing fields, and you see drugs behind every hedge. There's nothing for the kids to do. Mother turns into a taxi service unpaid. They've got to see their friends, learn to ride, remedial speech, whatever. Mother's gloomy and bored. Father's commuting. Now the Home Office idea has collapsed and become part of the divorce statistics. He met someone cheerful on the train. Someone who, like him, longs for a loft apartment in Islington. And if both country houses were sold and each took their half and mother kept the children, well, they are her life. Why, then the move back to the city could just about be managed for him. What's good for the children is not necessarily good for the marriage. But who's listening? We're moving out, friends say, thrilled to the gills. It will be different for us. And so it may be, and so I hope it will be. Humankind cannot live by reason alone, nor should they try to. And it is the spring, after all, and the mud's drying out, and the early sun catches the hilltops, and the wheat fields sprouting green and strong, and lambs bounce in the fields. And what's so good about here, anyway? I think I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you. Something that comes up quite a bit in these two pieces and in a lot of your pieces are all the ways in which modern life is not good for marriage.
I think you look at the statistics and you have to decide that it isn't, and you simply wonder why. And if you're me, you put it down to people working too hard and too long, and nobody having. It's the sort of sense is that nobody has time, I think, for romance.
But if we were going to make things better for marriage, what would we be doing?
Well, I suppose, I mean, you'd have to wonder if you wanted to make the world better for marriage.
That's what I was wondering.
You would have to work out if marriage was actually a good thing for anybody but children. You would have to wonder, you know, why individuals don't put their children first in these matters. So perhaps they shouldn't.
Well, there's so much written now about trying to change the script for marriage and make the world, you know, encourage people to get married and stay married. But every time I read one of these people, they're saying that the solution is for the woman in the marriage to just ask for a little less, work a little less, go along with other people's needs a little more. And so I'm left thinking, that's not so great.
No, but I mean, there is not a perfect answer. I think it would be better if fathers were given rather more say in the matter of bringing up their children. But I think fathers, many women, far from wanting fathers around, rather want them to go away. That once you have your children and you have a house and you have an income, in a kind of way, who wants a man about? Because they just argue with you as to how you're going to bring up the children and sort of get in the way and want food and the family unit seems, if the children are girls at any rate, seems to me to do fairly well with only a mother. I think in a family unit, if the mother has girls, then the family unit probably needs a man about. I mean, rationally, we should be turning men into equal parents, but everybody.
But
the feminists.
And why is that not happening?
Because men are seen as an optional extra, I think, by many women now.
Men are seen.
Men are seen as an optional extra and decorative, rather than. rather as men used to see women 30 years ago. I mean, I do feel the tables have turned here, rather, and that once upon a time it was men who were avoiding marriage and commitment, and now it seems to me rather more the women avoiding marriage and commitment.
Or women deciding, saying that if the marriage doesn't go according to certain rules, it's over, it's not necessary.
And the rules are not, I mean, our species nature and our sort of socialized nature are at odds with one another, I think, which is why it is difficult for mm-hmm. any of us to settle anymore, because mm-hmm. We have aspirations as women to, you know, to run our own lives, to be independent. We have to be. There's not much choice about it. And so, but somehow, I think, I mean, I do see a, I mean, I, you asked me earlier what the solution was, and there does seem to be one, which I, it seems to me they've adopted in France, which is to have a 35-hour working week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how that has gone, but if everybody, I mean, 35 hours anybody can manage out of a week to be at work and to have the children looked after. And but it's not like
well,
that.
In, I mean, I don't know that much about France, probably something
including
in the
working, including travelling to work.
But the structure of our work is so different here. I mean, it is, you know, there is better institutional childcare in France. People tend, there are more people who have regular jobs. When I hear about the 35-day week, I think, what a great idea, but how would it apply in my case with my 17,000 jobs? It wouldn't. And a lot of people work in very irregular ways and very sort of odd types of jobs. And it wouldn't mean anything to the people who are suffering most.
No,
I don't include myself in that. Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't want to be confined for 35-hour week because I'm sure I work more, but then I don't have small children in the home anymore.
But I want to point to something which looks like a contradiction in some of the writing that you do. You're saying, you know, women are regarding men as expendable and optional extras, and we're all being more independent and so on. But you also say, and I agree with the second thing, second comment about there being men, women, mothers, and fathers, and mothers are in the, you know, fathers are in a pretty bad position, but mothers are in an even worse position.
Yes.
Yes. So how do you hold those two things together?
Well, I think the father's but I don't see that these are contradictory necessarily.
I was hoping you'd say that. Yeah.
No. I don't think they're contradictory. I think we move from one phase to another. I mean, you move from being the young, if you're female, you move from being the young woman who these days, I think, has everything, who passes her exams, gets good degrees, finds it easy to get jobs, finds it easy to adjust, is at home in the technological world. Though I notice that nearly everyone who comes around to mend the computer is male. When she gets to be a mother, times get hard, if she gets to be a mother, and more women are opting not to have children because of the difficulty of actually managing all this, managing to have a decent life and time and space for children, and just isn't the kind who wants to juggle, as you've always, as women who've worked have always had to do.
But there are a lot of women who are opting to have children on their own and say it's because it makes their lives, because they can do it, because they have the money, and because he's so awful, get rid of him, whatever.
Yes.
But then they're in an even worse position. Even if they say they're happier, they're economically and in every other way in a much more difficult.
Well, you see, I think you're right. I think nothing is improved. I think things, in a kind of way, for women, things have got worse, not better. Over a lifespan, I think they've got perhaps rather worse. And it's not the feminist movement in that. It's feminist movement gave capitalism, if you like, gave permission. To send women out to work, to become part of the workforce, to kind of serve the needs of employers rather than their own human needs via the employer. All kinds of sort of convergent dynamics, all kinds of things happened. Women and the pill, I mean, medicine, advances in medicine, women able to control their own fertility, women able to have babies later and later in life, which has been, I think, a very good thing. But it has ended up in such a revolutionary change in the way we live, most of us, it's not surprising, I think, that we find it hard to make sense of it, to be totally rational about it.
But now we're in this quite a bit of a mess in which a lot of, for example, mothers are saying they're happier being poorer in a much more difficult situation and so on. Nobody has enough time, marriages are breaking up, and we've sort of got here by muddling, making women going back to work and muddling through, and here we are in this terrible mess. And is it all going to fix itself?
Yes. I think people are extremely ingenious at working out ways of, I sometimes think the mobile phone, which everyone thinks is so terrible, is actually a really good idea because we have to spend so much time travelling. I mean, coming up here on the train, it was, the buzz of the mobile phone, including mine, I may say, was quite wonderful. And I don't see why everybody shouldn't ring up and say, I'm on my way, or I'm on the train, or I'm coming home for dinner, because, we're born to chatter. The mobile phone allows us to chatter on with the people, the little group that we're with. I mean, it's a kind of very ingenious way. It's all people seem to do on the mobile phone, so far as I can see, is arrange meetings and pass on information, which could perfectly well wait for half an hour. But we don't want it to, and why should we not do what we want?
Well, that's how we got here. Yes. moving on to another question, you're often accused of inventing feminism. Yes. Why?
Me?
Yes.
Well, I didn't know about it. But, I started writing, as I was saying to your university magazine, I started writing out of a sense of indignation that, I didn't do literature. I come from a family of writers. I did not take literature, whose kind of work to pay the rent, really. So I didn't take it seriously. They just wrote, and really rather well, but it didn't sort of seem literature. It was just what people did. And I became indignant, I think, at the situation of women. But men 30 years ago, 25 years ago, because men were so rude to them. They were almost as rude about women as then as women are about men today. That's saying something. and you just sort of got fed up with it, and you got fed up with going out to work and sort of having to pretend at work that you didn't have a home and you didn't have children. It's pretty much the same now. But then when you got home, you had to pretend you didn't go out to work, or somehow, if you went out to work, it was your responsibility only to sort of make sure that there were, that the housework was still done. When you're going out to work was a sort of optional extra. And I got tired of going to the, and I went to see the tax inspector, a thing I've done at intervals throughout my life, to plead with them. And I remember her saying, and it was a woman and she was working, and she said, but you're married, what you earn is pin money. And I thought this was ridiculous, since it had been keeping the family, both with or without male help, for a long time. And I remember going to university and being in Scotland and being taught moral philosophy by a professor who didn't want to have women in his class. And there were four of us there, and he refused to mark our essays. And he would keep saying, women have no capacity for rational thought or moral discrimination. And, we sort of sat there, we accepted this in an odd way, but in retrospect, because, you just thought, either we're not women or he's nuts. But in all these little things move you to a sort of state of indignation, and that's what literature there was. And you realised why you'd always felt so odd as a woman, because all the books you read about all the books written by men about women didn't somehow accord with your life. They were kind of romances, really, claiming to be about real life. And being a reader, being born a reader, I think more than a writer, and just an avaricious reader, in the end, you kind of, in desperation, you write the book you want to read because no one else has written it. And they were in retrospect, I mean, from the very beginning, feminist books, because I looked at the world as it was. There wasn't a movement that I was conscious of when I began my first novel. I think I wrote 1967, a long time ago. Before the feminist movement had really got going. And it had, I think. I remember going to a David Frost program in which, as a group of American women had come over to protest at the Miss World contest, and they'd let off smoke bombs. And when you do these chat shows, they sit you in a part of the audience, so where everybody with your views sits. So, you know, the compare can point to somebody as if at random, but he knows what they're going to say because the researchers have sat them there or there or there. And I was sitting in that part of the audience with all the sort of contented housewives who went out to work and had no complaints. And I can remember, and these women who had thrown smoke bombs at Miss for principle, I mean, which I didn't particularly agree with and still don't, because I don't see why women shouldn't kind of, you know, if they want to flaunt, if you've got it, flaunt it. And if they want to do all this, no one is making them. So, you know, they should be allowed to do it. But, you know, you can argue with that. But it really upset me to hear the protesters described as lesbians, as envious of their prettier sisters, as unfeminine, and somehow put down in this incredibly humiliating way that men had in those days, and other women had, of putting any protesting woman down. And I just sort of thought, well, I'm sitting in the wrong place here, and kind of moved.
Moved.
And I moved. And you sort of physically moved and sat with the people who were on their side. And I think it was in that kind of, you know, that move that you just thought, well, these are martyrs, these are early martyrs to a cause which is actually, you know, if it goes through, is just going to shake the world. And it did, or certainly the Western world. And so, but I still, you know, there were never any party headquarters for feminism, there was never any manifesto. You never knew what anybody else was thinking, or, you know, there was a magazine called Spare Rib, which you could get quite a lot out of, but it got taken over by what was in those days called the Lavender Menace, which was the lesbian fringe, and it would sort of ended up full of accounts of how to get pregnant by coffee pot without the aid of a coffee pot spout and other things which really put people off. At the time, though now it doesn't seem, with all this genetic technology, it doesn't seem so extreme and extraordinary as it did at the time.
But just to move to another movement that you've been quite vocal about, and again, I sense it was a growing sense of irritation that got you to speak out about this, and that's therapism. How did that happen?
Oh, therapy. Well, that was sort of very personal, really. If only because I've been married for 30 years and my husband, who's now dead, went to a therapist and who said, you know, the marriage is clearly unworkable, doesn't work, is irrational and must be ended at once. And he kind of believed her because of the status that therapists had of knowing best, you see, and that is what I really objected to. But also because I had been to... I'd been asked before I became, it wasn't just that, it was because before, I mean, like many people who, I say, brought up in the 60s, but who had kind of, and I was in psychoanalysis for 8 years, I had always assumed that therapy was the answer if only we understood ourselves, you know, if only we all understood ourselves, we'd all be better people and not unhappy and so on. And that was the way forward. And then I was asked by a group of therapists in North London, proper sort of trained psychotherapists, to come and talk to them about the archetypes in my novel. And I can remember resisting this and saying, you know, well, I mean, you know, you're the Jungians, you tell me, you know. But they wanted me to go and talk about archetypes. So in the end, I said, yes, I would. And they were quite hostile. And I realized they were all very defensive. And that rather surprised me. It occurred to me that they all would be novelists, really. Well, most of them wanted to know how to get their novels published. And I thought, well, what's happened is they can't get their novels published, and so now they're using real people, and they will get a story out of them, and they will conclude that they will, according to the way they've been trained, it will be a certain genre of, you know, it'll be Freudian or Jungian or Kleinian or whatever it is, and they will kind of put this narrative account onto this person's life, and then they will bring it to a conclusion, the conclusion they want. But people aren't like that. They're much sort of vaguer and more difficult to define, and the conclusion, which is the cure, somehow isn't really honestly available. And I felt they were somehow, I lost all faith in them then. And then afterwards we went out for a Chinese meal, and as one does. And and they sat around these therapists, and they all knew one another, and they were talking about a couple they all knew. They were using real names. They were one of the therapists was a Church of England vicar, and he had a little beard, and he had wonderful sort of calm brown kind eyes. And that he was treating the wife of somebody in the church who was, I then realized from the conversation, was after the same job as his. And they decided around that table that they were going to tell her, not even advise her, that she was to leave this man because he was no good for her. And they would be better apart. And I said, how old are they? And she said, oh, in their 60s. And I said, well, what about loneliness? And they all turned on me as one and said, we don't talk about loneliness, we talk about aloneness. And I went back home, and I rang up my husband, who was in therapy from where I just parted, in absolute panic, and said, you know, these are not good people. What they want is for them to know best, and us all to be separated off from one another. And then I made a joke about relate on the radio and called it separate. And it was a joke, but the people from relate were around by that very lunchtime, I can tell you, at my house, saying I wasn't to say these things in public. It had funding implications. And that was the end for me, and I started writing vile things about therapy. But now, you see, I have to admit this, but my younger son has now gone into psychoanalysis, you see, with migraine, and he needs something. But again, I will tell you this, but he's my fourth son, you see. Now my third son went to prison, you see, and that was incredibly good for him. And a year later, you know, he's got a job and a partner and a child, and is terribly, blissfully happy, and, you know, and good and sane and all the rest of it. Well, you know, a year from now, what is this younger son going to be like? I bet you he's not talking to me. He may be better, but I will be gone, because obviously, you know, I mean, what sort of mother am I? Yeah.
At this point, we're going to open it out, if that's all right. And when you ask questions, I'll try to remember what the question is and repeat it so that everybody else can misunderstand it along with me. Are there any questions?
I wonder what you think about the teenage birth rate. It seems to be such a dreadful shame. It's such a bad start in life for the mother, because she's really starting life too, and of course, the child.
Could I just say, this is about the teenage birth rate, which seems to be a terrible shame for the mother as well as for the child.
Yes, it does. And yet, you see, I know women lot of in their 50s and 60s now who got pregnant when very young and had abortions and regret it. Because somehow, you know, life goes on so long and you have this child when early. And it's, of course, I mean, on the face of it, it interferes with your education. It depends on the background, it depends on the child, it depends upon the relationship. And I say this, I mean, and get into terrible trouble for it, but if nature says you are ready to have a baby, you have all the emotions that go with it. And the kind of the abuse of the emotion by saying getting rid of the baby is almost sort of worse than having the baby. I mean, you know, it's a very difficult matter. The answer is, of course, is not to let them sort of have sex in the first place. you know, how do you do that? The more sex education there is, it seems to me, the more and the girls mature very much younger than they did, and so do boys. And everybody is healthy and energetic and get to this stage before we think in our adult view, before they're emotionally ready. But I don't know if anybody is ever emotionally ready for anything, really. I don't know. You know, I don't know what the answer is, except I think the way sex education is done is, I mean, it embarrasses everybody, it seems to me. Children don't like it, teachers don't like doing it, nobody knows what, I mean.
You're not allowed to say anything anyway.
And nobody likes to sort of say anything, and the teachers can't say very much because, you know, some parents will object, other parents will say it's not enough. If the child had a proper relationship with the parent, no doubt, and the parents weren't out at work all the time, they might be able to answer the children's questions. And in a way, the information is asked for. I mean, the traditional way, it was you just told when children asked you. You told them, you answered their questions truthfully. They would somehow dictate the rate at which they got this information, which is rather difficult before you have sexual emotions, because the whole thing sounds so disgusting. Faces. And I said, no, honestly, it's true. And he said, oh, well, don't eat me again. It was something about seeds, you know, I obviously told him. And, you know, but I sort of feel this bumbling way of going about it maybe is probably a better way. But if you sit a class of children down and tell them about sex, when some of them want to know more and some of them want to know less, and the actual chronological age is so irrelevant to all this, which governments never recognise, I think, how little chronological age means in a child's life and development. It's one of these other things. I don't know what the answer is, really. In a way, when the girls and the boys were educated separately, I think there was more passion, there was more prudery at the bottom end and more passion at the other end. But I don't suppose we will ever go back to that. Who could afford it? Though we did stop, I mean, up to a point, there were no mixed wards in the hospitals anymore. At least they have all the men up that end, all the women down that end.
Unless you have cancer.
Unless you have cancer, yeah. When you're all in together.
Yes. There was another question, yes.
Yes. Both my grandmothers were having their children in the 30s and the 40s in Spain, when the word feminism did not exist. And no much was expected of them, just to feed them and clothe them, send them to school and send them to church and to bring them up as decent children. Now, I brought my children in the 70s and in the 80s, and I also have to work and deal with a lot of stress. I'm traveling around the countryside, exactly as you said. And now, it annoys me when I see the Catholic Church saying there is plenty to protect the family in the civil and political treaty of the United Nations, and there is, I mean, we are only protected, the family is only protected if the man is decent. I am going to the most horizon of the world, and I would like to see you write in the kind of book that you showed one generation, two generations back, showing these women that not so much was expected of them. We're supposed to look pretty and entertain clients and build up the husband's career, and then one day the husband runs away with the career and everything.
and you are left with nothing. You are with the lawyers and the lawyer.
I think.
That's what I like you to write to be paid.
Yes.
In how much have we with the families or because
yes.
of our family and anything?
No, but
I can't repeat that question.
No, well, let me say, I mean, I have written a book about a grandmother and a granddaughter, actually, and it's not quite, which is coming out in September, but it's not quite along those lines. But it's what, you see, again, when I was first involved with in the 70s, writing these books, one was so conscious of that the women were encouraged to be dependent. And then the men let them down, and there was nothing, and they had nothing, because their lives were lived so much through the family relationship, through the husband, through the children. When the children were grown, if the husband walked out, there was nothing, and they were destroyed. And it was the most, and power, men used this power badly, and the whole thing was always about men running off with younger women, and because, you know, they kind of married some pretty young girl, set about turning them into their mother, and when they'd turned them into their mother, looked for the next sort of pretty young girl. But I don't think that sort of preoccupies people much anymore. It's something rather different and but
well,
as difficult.
My grandfathers didn't expect much of my grandmothers. They only had to bring at the boys
yes. And at the end of the day, you still, well, you have something. I mean, you have your dignity, your self-respect, and the capacity to earn. No.
Well, so, I think it goes back to the points that you've been making that women at the, if they are making children the center of their lives and they're not earning as much as the men, yes, if the divorce happens, they're not in a good position. You know, the weaker economic partner is never.
No.
The person who's taking charge of the children is never.
Is never free.
Is never in a strong position.
No.
And can be exploited just as much now or more, I would say.
But you see, there are lots of men groups who complain bitterly that what the women can do to the men is, you know, the husband is going to work and the wife is at home or going out to work part-time and she has children, and then one day she falls in love with somebody else and she says to the man, I'm going to divorce you.
Yes, and then the other man runs away.
And then, no, not necessarily.
Okay.
And then, not necessarily. and the wife will then get the house and support and maintenance, because the courts always support, you know, keep the children in the home, and the woman will have been looking after them. And then the wife moves the lover in, and the husband, who has done nothing but kind of carry on as he always has, is left living in a bed sitting room somewhere with denied access to his children. And, you know, this is an extreme examples, but it does happen.
No, it happens quite a bit, actually.
And the courts have put the power, I think it has moved with no fault divorces. I mean, the trouble is that, you know, no blame is apportioned any longer, it seems to me, in the courts, because there isn't time. Because, you know, half as many people are getting divorced as are getting married. And so, you know, what can the courts do but make property settlements and unmarry people like that? But it is, I mean, it remains, you know, it just remains a very, very painful thing for women who take marriage seriously, and not all do, or who believe it to be permanent, or hope that it will be permanent. It's the most shattering thing, and it goes on happening, and there is no saving it except for sort of generations of women who take very good care not to become emotionally involved with men emotionally dependent upon men, trained by therapists not to have negative emotions or avoid them at all costs.
The plot thickens.
So the answer, and love then becomes, you know, neurotic dependency.
Jeremy.
You were saying beforehand, somebody, that you just joined the Church of England.
Yes, that's true.
Is that the same thing as becoming a Christian? And either way, what does it mean?
Oh, Well, I don't know, because I haven't sort of really written about this, so I don't know what I think. It sort of tends to work that way around. I joined the Church of England, I think, because it seemed appropriate, because I belonged, because I like going to this particular church, which you know, which is St. John's in Hampstead, which is must be one of the nicest churches in the country. And I like the building, and I love singing hymns. And I see nothing wrong with, you know, getting together with other people and saying, you know, and in a group saying you're really sorry for what you've done. And you will try and do better next time. And I felt extremely excluded because other people would go up and have communion and I sort of couldn't because I was neither christened nor baptized. So I was not confirmed. So I went and was christened and confirmed. And now I can go and take communion with other people and I like going to church. And that those are my reasons. Now, as to belief, you know, the actual rational belief of the Christian, I don't know. It seems to me just an escalation of doubt. Really, that I have let myself in for. But, you know, given that, I mean, it seems a whole sense of a world you come out of a culture in which, certainly as a woman of my generation, you understand the significance of sacrifice, if you like, which is what younger women now have no sense of at all, I think, that actually if something is to be gained, something has to be given up. Well, you give it up, and people are very reluctant to give up anything. Yes, and and this is sort of part of the belief of a religion. It is, I think it goes very far back into sort of, you know, matters of pagan matters of birth and rebirth. It is, but it's not new agey. It's a kind of discipline of a sort of discipline of trying to believe, of getting getting to understand. Once upon a time you had to believe literally, you see, it's got much easier now in the Church of England because even the bishops don't really believe. So, you know, all you have to do is to believe more than your bishop and you're kind of you're a Christian. Well, that do, Jeremy. And I think everybody should do it. I think they should all, and you know, and here are the churches, here are these places, still open, often very beautiful, often run by very irritating people, I do agree. But nevertheless, this sort of central core of belonging is there. And it's also the Church of England, and you know, where is England now? You know, it's all, England has almost become a place that isn't Ireland, Scotland or Wales, and it's sort of strangely sort of non-thing, except there is the Church of England. Well, you know, that's what I belong to now. I'm English. That's right. Proud of it.
Yeah.
I
don't
know if your grandfather was alive.
Yes.
But you are. There was something very strange when I was in Holland, something very strange that things are happening. Yashimai's article I read. In the late 60s, there was a very strong feminist movement going on in Holland, particularly in Amsterdam. And all these feminists, these very strong feminists, have now become grandmothers. And they're all very devoted grandmothers. And there are sort of, yeah, one of them actually was very upset because her daughter wants an abortion. And so it seems as if the whole thing is like a sort of guilt that suddenly come back and that's now protected also their grandchildren, which I just try to work out how that works, how you see that from your experience.
A précis of this question, for those of you who didn't hear it, it's about strong feminists in Holland from the late 60s are now finding themselves grandmothers and acting rather oddly. Yeah? Okay. devoted, don't want your daughters to have abortions and things like that. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I mean, it would be interesting to know what they feel about the boys or the girls. I mean, you feel there is much sort of stronger concern with the girls than there is with the boys, which always seems... I mean, nowadays, young people tend to want to have girls rather than boys. It used to be the opposite, and this is a great reversal, I think, really, because the kind of feeling is that girls now probably have a better life than boys. I don't know, you know, they're kind of easier. Girls are sort of easier to rear. The world is suited to them. And But I think when you get older, you kind of realize the value of human relations. You realize the value of family. You realize the value of in a way of inheritance, of a shared background, of a shared way of being. And many women I find very distressed because suddenly their daughters don't have babies or don't want to have babies. And I think especially a lot of our Jewish friends who feel this really acutely, because this sort of sense of the generations going back and the struggle to survive and the struggle to make things better. And so perhaps suddenly, I mean, perhaps we are back in Eden and perhaps we have got as far as we can go almost and are left with the terrible complexities. And somehow there seems almost no need for some women to have another generation, which is going to make things better. And so there is in that generation a kind of shortage of grandchildren, which makes the ones who have them really quite passionately involved. I mean, I'm not a particularly good grandmother myself. I mean, I really like to see them, but you know, but then I have other things to do, and it may be, just as women who were so dedicated to their children once upon a time had very little else to do or little else that they could do, so it is with. As you get older, you tend to get more voiceless, unless somebody like me just never stops. You know. And then again, this human relationship seems so valuable.
Catherine.
Staying with gender politics, I feel like I would not spend feminism because, first of all, as a young woman, I think it's a lot for me. But, I'm in a situation where my boyfriend kicks me the other night. He knows how to iron my bed. As far as I'm concerned, feminism is becoming a historical subject. Do you anticipate that being a backlash coming so that we can be defending men who are treated so badly?
I think you're probably right. I think it has to change its tack and not defend. It has to start defending sort of the human race from itself rather than women for men. I mean, I think what goes wrong for women is not men any longer. It's not a male conspiracy to keep them in their place. It's their physiology. It's their biological existence which prevents them, if it does, when it does, from being equal. It is the kind of whole emotional state that we go on being in, which is what we somehow have to pay attention to, and you have to look after in order to be happy. In order for the children to be happy, you need to look after the welfare. You need to look after the feelings of men, if you like, rather more than the feelings of women. And so, in a sense, I mean, the old feminism, which. Is, I think, rather outmoded. And yet, you see, you look at the non-technological world, you look at the Taliban, and you think, well, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. I mean, to what extent is this cultural, to what extent is this, you know, male power over the female? I mean, can it revert to something like that if you're not careful? I don't know. I think, you know, if we lost the use of the computer and the use of electricity or whatever, we would be back to a primitive state in 2 seconds, really. But, you know, I think people are capable of great change. Societies are capable of great and quite sudden change. Look at what happens. Look at what happens in Russia, in 1917 in Russia, when, you know, an entire, all those millions of people suddenly believed in Marxism-Leninism. I mean, and how extraordinary an event that was. And yet, I mean, or when kings used to take up a certain religion and everybody, the whole country followed, or certain attitudes. And so, you know, groups of people do change. Men, I think, learned extraordinarily quickly, once the word sexism had been coined, which it hadn't existed before the 70s. Once that was there as a kind of concept, just as racism hadn't been invented, hadn't been kind of understood as a concept. As soon as you understand that concept, you try to do better. And to a very large extent, I think men in the West have managed, and most men, except for the old dinosaurs, are newish which I think, you know, is rather bad for their potency, actually. That's another, you know, that's another story.
We're sort of running out of time. I know of two other questions here, and if you could try to be brief. Yeah?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, you've been talking quite a lot about young women, how feminism is, you know, they're liberated and young educated and past women. You're talking a lot about that. What about, I think there's a great disparity of, those raising expectations actually enabled me, for example, to really feel liberated in the ways that I think feminism was aiming for. But would you say that those same expectations have actually led, you know, for example, the feminization of poverty is a lot of young single mothers and whatever. I know you were talking about it as if it was a social problem about young women, but I feel that it's a sort of class, it's a definite class issue.
Mm.
Do you think these expectations have actually made life a lot more difficult for those women who don't have the opportunity to get educated and have these choices?
Yes, I think it has. I think it has made it difficult because all women, once upon a time, the working man. I mean, the first man I ever married said, "No wife of mine goes out to work. You know, I'm man enough to keep you." And he was a teacher, and that I found very trying indeed, because that meant if you wanted a pair of shoes, you had to ask, and he would say, "Well, what's wrong with the ones you've got on?" That was true. Nothing except I think it is a class issue, and I think you are right. I think life, feminism has not, other than to make it necessary. I mean, otherwise, other than to bring about a society in which one wage won't keep a family, so that the women have to go out to work as well as have children. Life is harder for women than it was, because that sort of working class, respectable culture has gone. Mind you, I mean, women don't have to have babies. You don't have to have a baby anymore. You really don't. You want to have a baby. And it's the easiest thing in the world to have a baby, because you just lie down and do what nature intends. And if you don't sort of stop it or go to the doctor, you do nothing, and 9 months later there's a baby. I mean, you know, it's sort of like you have to opt out, really. You have to consciously, and it's a difficult thing to do, which I'm sure is why most women, lots of women, young women end up with babies, because they don't have the energy, will, or the sense to stop it.
Say no more. We both have four, so we're even. Okay.
Ben, could you do a nice, simple wrap-up question?
So I was to say, my parents divorced when I was quite young. It's my father who raised me and my sister. Mm. And I think that's still quite a rare thing today, but I was wondering if you think it become more common.
I'm sure it has become much more common, and women are more likely, there is much less social disapproval, much more social acceptance. It used for a woman to leave the children for the man to bring up was considered absolutely shocking and completely out of order. But now, you know, the genders are sort of, it is more common than it used to be, and not so extraordinary. And the woman will say, "Well, you know, I'm just not by nature so cut out for this kind of thing. And if you obviously are, so I'm off." And you look after them, and you know, which is what men say about women, you know. But we are more equal now, and it happens.
So you're optimistic after all this?
Yeah, I was just sort of born Pollyanna, really. You know, okay. I don't know how to, it will be all right.
Thank you very much for coming this evening. Thank you very much, Faye. That was wonderful. And when will you come back again? Final question.
Yes, <go back. laughs>